Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So I got to tell you, we've done over 800 episodes, but I got to tell you that this is one that I'm really excited about. As the saying goes, once you're lucky, twice you're good. And in this case, you know, like our founder today has built not one, but multiple billion-dollar companies. Now he is on his third rocket ship. We're going to be talking about it. We're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing, acquisitions, taking your company public, hiring, all the good stuff that we like to hear. So brace yourself for a very inspiring episode. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Renaud LaPlanche. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So originally born in the beautiful city of Paris, but grew up in the south of France. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
It was fun, actually. Growing up in the south of France was really nice. I mean, it's nice weather. It's a pretty like slow-paced life, but lots of interesting people. And I was into sailing at the time. I'm still is to some extent. I was spending 3-4 days at school, 3-4 days out on the water. It was a nice way to grow up.
And how did you come up with the whole combination of business and law? You know, people will typically either go into one or the other direction, but how did that combination come about for you?
Yeah, you know, it's I always found it very complementary. And I'm not one of these reformed lawyers who was like bored at a law firm and couldn't wait to get out. I actually enjoyed practicing law. I think I think anything you do in life can be very interesting and you can be creative even in you practice law or accounting, things that you wouldn't think of being bringing up your creative skills. I think you can always ways to be innovative and to go where nowhere has gone before charter new ground.
Yeah, because in this case for you, once you got your degree, you ended up joining a U.S. law firm called Cleary Gottlieb that was ultimately your bridge into the U.S. But there you spent actually close to 5 years. So 5 years gives you access to many learnings, many lessons learned. So I guess in your case, what do you think that practicing law and studying law gave you from a frame of reference and perspective that would serve you later on in life?
Yeah, I think the practicing law at a top law firm like Cleary Gottlieb really gives you a great sort of overview of a lot of different businesses, right? And that's something you get also if you start at an investment firm or a consulting company. It's a good way to start your career, I find, because it really gives you exposure to different industries, different businesses, different founders and executives. And give you a sense of what works and what doesn't. I think that's a positive. And then the practice of law itself, as I was saying, could be really creative. And it's all about, you know, you have a problem in front of you and you have a toolbox and it's all about choosing the right tool. And if the right tool is unavailable, it's about crafting a tool that would help you in that case. I found it really sort of rewarding.
So how did you get your ticket to come to the U.S.? How did that happen?
Yeah, so the firm made the decision that they probably regretted in hindsight, but they offered me to spend 6 months to a year at the New York office. And the idea was an ability to really sort of meet more of the U.S.-based partner and then come back to Paris. But, you know, it was 1999. It was a great time to leave a cushy, well-paid job at a bank or a law firm and really start a new company. And obviously, lots of things were happening on the internet and in software at that time. So it was a great time to raise money and get it going.
But that's quite the shift of careers, Renaud. You know, like switching from the legal side of things and pushing paper, you know, as lawyers would do in New York, especially in New York. Oh, my God. I guess, how did that idea of giving your notice and venturing into the unknown, how did that come up?
Yeah, you know, this idea of a search technology that actually I needed as a lawyer, right? The search capabilities we had internally were really not great, and we were spending and wasting a lot of time looking for precedents and correspondence. And at the time, I met someone in New York who was finishing his PhD in artificial intelligence and information retrieval. And so with my business ideas and his technology, we thought we had something, and we decided to launch Matchpoint, which was a sort of enterprise search engine, so sort of a Google for inside the firewall. So technology that I needed as a user, and we found was missing in the world.
And how was that adjustment to now becoming an entrepreneur and putting fires out?
Yeah, it was quite a bit of an adjustment, you know. As a like fifth year associate in a big law firm, you have a lot of support staff, and you don't get your hands dirty much. So I went from that to assembling IKEA furniture in a tiny office right above a McDonald's, a 24/7 McDonald's. So we were smelling burgers every hour of the night and day. You know, with no support, and you do it all yourself, and you're constantly in the early days. I find it actually really exhilarating. But in the early days, I mean, you're constantly sort of moving up or down, right? You're like doing some like very sort of day-to-day mundane tasks. And then you're thinking about the long-term strategy of the business. And then you're going back to assembling IKEA desk for the next employee that's coming next week. So it's a lot of scaling up and down, but just very very formative as a young entrepreneur.
So also first company, first exit. So quite a good hitting rate right there. So walk us through how the acquisition with Oracle came about. Make us insiders there for a minute.
Yeah, we were lucky that at the time both Microsoft and Oracle were sort of investing in search technologies, and Google and internet search engines were becoming so sophisticated and working so well that there was growing frustration for professionals to not have the same experience inside the firewall, and not being able to sort of seamlessly, easily, quickly retrieve the information they needed to do their job. So all the big software companies were investing in search at the time. So we were lucky to have two bidders for the business, and Oracle ended up being the high bid, and we decided to sell. And it was a pretty easy decision at the time between like selling the business or keep it going, because we could see how there was consolidation and a lot of CTOs and CIOs inside large enterprises were still hesitant to go with that like small technology company, small software company that didn't have a lot of financial stability, where we raised like a couple of rounds but didn't have a lot of cash. But the technology was great and worked really well. So it felt like we would be more successful as part of a larger software powerhouse like Oracle or Microsoft.
What kind of visibility would you say that this gave you into the full cycle of a business? Because here you were able to go through every single base that you can think of building, scaling, and also exiting. So I guess, from a 30,000-foot view, what kind of visibility did that give you into the cycle of a company?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, in 5 years, we went from the idea stage to raising money to almost running out of money, making payroll with my own paycheck literally a couple of times, to actually our headquarters were in the World Trade Center in 2001. we lost our headquarters, and we lost like quite a bit of technology and some paperwork. So having to like rebuild, regroup. Fortunately, we didn't lose any employees on September 11th. So, but that suddenly slowed down the business and that slowed down the economy a lot. So, was hard for like 9 to 12 months, and then recovered from that and really experienced fast growth and success for a couple of years. And then the exit and the negotiations and so really the full cycle, as you said, and then the sort of integration from the standpoint of the acquiree, integration into a large companies. I think like Oracle has 30,000 employees or so at the time. So yeah, very very different work environment. Really sort of interesting task to relaunch Matchpoint as an Oracle product, and retain the employees, and then transition the brand and the customer base. So that was really interesting, and to think that it all happened inside of 6 years was really really exciting.
That's amazing. Now, after the acquisition, you went to Oracle and you did the famous besting and resting. I'm not sure how much resting was there, but definitely you did it for 1 year and 1 day. So it was like literally on the dot, boom, you gave your notice. So give us an insider look or perspective into how the idea of your next company came about, LendingClub, and how did you go from ideation all the way to incubation and to the launch of the business?
Yeah, so the idea again came to me as a user, right? So I was in my living room opening the mail, and so the first piece of mail I opened was my credit card statement, where I was discovered that I was paying 18% interest rate on my credit card balance, which I thought was a really high rate. But then the next piece of mail I opened was my savings account statement, where my high yield savings account, where at the time I was earning like 0.5%. So I thought, okay, wait a minute, that's a really big spread. If I basically lend money to the bank, they give me 0.5%. If I borrow from the bank on my credit card, I'm going to pay 18. Where is all that money going? So that really was the idea of LendingClub, of creating a marketplace that would essentially shortcut the banks, cut out the middleman, and bring on both sides of the marketplace. On one side, people who need the money; on the other side, people who have the money, and let them give them the tools to enter into credit agreements, so into loans, into personal loans, so that like savers, investors would earn more than 0.5%. And people borrowing the money would pay less than 18.
And in this case, I would say that LendingClub was one of the companies that paved the way for the whole fintech, you know, revolution, right? I mean, you guys launched the platform in 2007. So I'm sure that, you know, now, obviously, you know, like there is a nice path to follow for all these fintechs that are launching. But I'm sure that really blending in not only the securities or the regulatory compliance with perhaps the also the uncertainty of building a company from nothing, blending those uncertainties into one, I'm sure that was not easy.
Yeah, no, a lot of hurdles. And as you said, I think we were lucky to pave the way for sort of consumer fintech. But that means there was a lot of uncertainty at the beginning, regulatory uncertainty, as you said. Like, we were not sure if these like fraction of loans would be considered securities or not. And we had a lot of discussions with the SEC, and they said, yeah, they are securities. So we had to shut down the platform for 6 months to register the entire program as essentially a public offering of securities. But went for it because we did it voluntarily. I think the SEC was helpful in the process, and we were able to do it relatively quickly and have a pretty clean break and clean launch, relaunch. But there were like other issues. I mean, just like I think the lack of comfort at the time for transacting online, and particularly entering into financial transactions with or through a platform that just had been around for a couple of years and wasn't well known at all, but it was clearly a challenge. I mean, banks aren't great at delivering great consumer experience or a lot of customer satisfaction, but they are really good at establishing trust. Right? People generally don't love their bank, but they trust it. They know it's always going to be there because it's been there for some case 400 years, and there's FDIC insurance and all that. When you're entering into financial transactions with a company that's been around for 2 years, I think now trust has been built, but at the time it had not. So it was really even the beginning of e-commerce. So just like this like spot transaction when you're buying something, it was fine. And entering into a 3 or 5 year term loan with a company that's been around for 2 years is quite a leap of faith. So we really had to build that trust over time.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Now, I want to now bring you a little bit back in time. That's going to be December 10th, 2014. You guys are ringing the bell. And basically, you know, one of the biggest IPOs in 2014. What goes through your mind that day?
Yeah, it was a good day. It was certainly a lot of pride as a founder when you do a big IPO like this, and we were able to hang a giant sort of landing club logo on the facade of the New York Stock Exchange on Broad Street. Had a lot of our customers were there. We were able to invite lots of employees, everybody wearing the landing club colors. And so we had 100, 120 employees on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. All the TVs were there. I was on CNBC from the exchange. It was a lot of pride and I think good branding opportunity. I mean, if you're running a consumer company, being public, it could cut both ways when the stock doesn't go the right way. But if the stock performs reasonably well, it's a good opportunity to align interests between your like retail shareholders and your customers, especially in the case of Lending Club, where a lot of the customers, a lot of the investors were on the retail side of the platform, were also like investors in the loans and investor in the stock. So there's some synergies there when things go well.
So at the peak of the valuation, you know, it was $10 billion. So really incredible journey. But obviously, you know, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And in May of 2016, it's time to turn page. And then you decide it's time to launch another rocket ship. So walk us through how did this sequence of events, you know, unfolded there for you to take action and get going with Upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, first my exit from Lending Club, I mean, it was a pretty pretty public disagreement with the board. I mean, we had some compliance issues and a lot of disagreements as to who was to blame for it and what to do about it to fix it. So I left the company then. But a lot of the sort of top team also disagreed with the way the board handled the situation. So they all left at the same time. So we had actually everything we needed to like, start a new platform. And a lot of the sort of Lending Club shareholders who were not on the board also sided with us. So they said, whatever you guys do, we want in. So we had the sort of the capital, the people, and the knowledge to start a new platform. And I think the idea, and also, I mean, when you run a company like Lending Club for 10 years, you learn a lot. And there's this long list of things that was, say, all the things we'd do differently if we had the opportunity to start over again. And so we got that opportunity. So we incorporated all these learnings into the design of Upgrade. And then one of the big learnings was, I think one of the mistakes, strategic mistakes we made at Lending Club was to remain sort of monoline, to remain the single product company for too long. And I think the personal loan product was a great product, very useful for consumers to get rid of credit card debt and really sort of handle their credit the right way in a way that's more affordable and more responsible, paying down their debt every month with a personal loan rather than these like revolving credit cards. So it's a useful product for consumers, very big market, growing fast, but we should have we should probably have done more, launched more product while personal loan was growing so fast. And so when we designed Upgrade, we really designed it as a more as a multi-product platform from the get-go, and have sort of mobile banking, credit cards, personal loans, home improvement, auto loans. And there are a lot of benefits, obviously a lot of synergies between these different products, and a lot of benefits for consumers. When they start thinking of you not as a product, but really as a platform, as a partner that's going to be there for like all the all their financial needs, that's really how we thought about Upgrade early on, and what it's become over the last 6 years.
And when we're talking about what it has become, you know, for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of Upgrade? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so it's really a sort of neobank, right? So we have mobile banking and all kinds of credit products. Obviously, the more customers do with us, the more benefits they have, right? They keep their bank accounts with us. They can get a higher line on their credit card, lower rates on their loans, because we have more data, we have a better understanding of what's going on in their life, so we can underwrite and service these customers better. And the way we make money is typically by getting sort of fees paid either by customers or by loan buyers. And we're still a balance sheet light and capital light business, so we don't have a big balance sheet. We typically originate loans and card balances and then sell them to banks, credit unions, asset managers. So it's still a platform, still a marketplace. It's not a retail marketplace, so there are professional investors on the other side, but it's of similar idea in terms of not being the bank, but really so, or being the like the face of the bank on the consumer side, but really outsourcing the entire sort of capital formation and balance sheet to investors.
So for Upgrade now, you guys have raised $587 million, and it's reported that the valuation, you know, is looking at $6.3 billion, which is remarkable. I'm sure that, you know, this time around, especially you know, after your previous rodeos and the dynamics that you encounter, you know, abort levels and stuff like that, how did you go about doing things differently at a corporate and governance perspective?
Oh, how much time do you have? yeah, it's like everything is different, right? In terms of sort of organizational structure. So, one thing we did very early on is all these of operations are in Phoenix, Arizona. So everything that's labor intensive is in a low cost location, something we didn't do at Landing Club at the time. Even for engineering, where we have a core engineering team in San Francisco, it's pretty distributed. Beyond that, we have two great engineering centers in Canada, where there's a great talent pool, but lower cost of living and a very sort of loyal base of engineers that's been doing a great job for us, but at a lower cost than what we would see in the Bay Area. The board and our relations with investors is different. We really sort of wanted to keep control of the company. So we still haven't sold any share with voting rights. We still, as the founders, have all the voting rights. So there are protective provisions for investors. We have veto controls, obviously, and some we can't like go raise money without them agreeing or merge the company or that kind of things. But so there are protective provisions, so it's well designed and investors are happy with that setup. But in terms of day-to-day running the company, that really gives us the full control over decisions and how we organize the board and how the board works. Really in the interest of the shareholders, which is not what we really saw at Landing Club, where at some point there was divergence and the board really worked in its own interest and against the shareholders. And that's why so many of the Landing Club shareholders sided with us at the time.
So now, Renaud, imagine you were to go to sleep tonight. And you wake up in a world where the vision of Upgrade is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, so we really became one of the most trusted and loved consumer brands in the US, but in the world. I mean, if I can choose when that icon, if I wake up in, depending if I wake up in 5 years or in 20 years. But it's really about that. It's really about building trust with customers and having really customers see us as their partner and as like someone who's in their corner and is going to help them through all the big events in their life and even the small ones day to day. When we launch a new product, customers are excited and they'd much rather have that product from Upgrade than from anybody else, because they know that the terms of that product and the conditions and the pricing has really been sort of designed in the best interest of our customers.
So let's say I bring you back in time now. I put you into a time machine, Renaud, and I bring you back in time. I bring you back in time to that moment where it's 99. And you are now, you've literally given your notice at the law firm. You are coming out of the firm, you know, literally One Liberty Plaza in New York City, to make it even more visual. And let's say you're able to stop on the tracks that the younger Renaud that is coming out of the building, and you're able to sit that younger self down for a cup of coffee, and you're able to give that younger Renaud one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
To really focus on the people, focus on the founders, the first few hires, because these have so much impact on culture and success, right? I mean, the first people you're going to surround yourself with, whether they're co-founders or the early employees, I mean, they're the ones who are going to sort of hire the next level down, and then these guys are going to hire the next level down. And so if you don't have a great alignment and the right skill set at the top, you're doomed. None of it. It doesn't matter how good the idea is. The execution isn't going to follow. So really, like, surrounding yourself with the best people, and best really takes a lot of time to define, right? It's not absolute best. There's going to be the people who are going to share your vision, are going to share your excitement, or going to say, yes, I'm going to make a lot of sacrifices in the next 5 or 10 years, but it's all worth it because this is where we want to go, and this is what we want to build together. So it needs to be that alignment and that energy, but also the skill set and the experience, right? I mean, I started a software company without being a technologist, and two finance companies without being without having any at least the first one without having any of experience in consumer finance or banking. So it's really key to surround yourself with people who have different skill sets, different experiences, and can be like complementary, and like be good in the areas you're not so good, and vice versa.
I love it. So Reno, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I'm on LinkedIn, or they can send me an email. It's orleplanche@upgrade.com. I read all my emails. I try to respond to all. If I don't respond the first time, send a new one, and you'll most likely hear back from me.
Amazing. Well, hey, Reno, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It was great to be on. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.